Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tottenham. Thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our sixth look at the Texas killing fields. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just look for Deathcast or Deathcast Podcast. You can also help support the show by going to your favorite podcast app and leaving a five-star review, or you can go to tinyurl.com/dcast. Patreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early and ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content, just like my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did, as well as the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Samantha, Debbie, Betty, and Matt. They all went to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Alright, now that all that's out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week. We had discussed the murder of Crystal Jean Baker and the subsequent conviction, Kevin Edison Smith, the murders of Lynette Bibbs, Tamara Fisher, and Donna Marie Prudhomme. We are still in the 1990s. The next group of disappearances and murders we're going to be discussing are unique in that they're going to be solved as a lone perpetrator is going to be found to have committed them, which is going to be the first time in any of these killings that we have confirmed serial killer being active. The next young girl we're going to be talking about is Laura Smithers, who was born to electrical engineer Bob Smithers and his first wife, Carol, on April 23rd, 1984. Within a year of Laura being born, her mother, Carol, ends up passing away from breast cancer. Bob's second wife, a South African woman by the name of Gay, ends up coming into both Bob and Laura's life at the recommendation of their pediatrician, as Bob was looking for someone who could take care of Laura while he was at work, and Gay, who happened to be on a world tour, you know, really just kind of sowing her oats while looking for a job in America. Gay ends up taking the job, stating later that she absolutely fell in love with Laura upon the first time meeting the toddler. And in 1986, Bob ends up marrying his nanny. This is in 1986, and a few years after this, the couple welcome another child to the family in 1988 by the name of David. Now, initially, the family had lived in Houston. However, by 1990, they decided to go to one of the smaller outlying hamlets of the Houston metropolitan area, ending up in a town known as Friendswood, which is about a half hour south of downtown Houston. It's interesting to note that as the Smithers children grew up, their parents decided that a public school education just wasn't cutting it, and they pulled them out of public school, and Gay, who had a teaching degree in English, began to homeschool the children. Outside of that, the two Smithers children seemed to have a fairly normal childhood. We know that Laura took ballet lessons from a very young age. Because of this love of ballet, Laura begins to work out. This is fairly common among dancers, as in order to do professional dancing, you need to be pretty damn strong. This led to Laura first riding her bike and then going out and jogging. Now, at the time all of this happened, Friendswood was going through a metamorphosis, with subdivisions springing up all throughout the area. So the sight of Laura, her brother, her father, out running through the streets was a fairly common one. As we move forward to April 3rd, 1997, when Laura is preparing to turn 13 years old. Now, on that morning of April 3rd, Laura had a conversation with her mother. As Laura was very health conscious, she talked to her mother about not doing any more fad diets and instead taking up exercise. After this small conversation, while Gay and David were making breakfast, Laura asked Gay if she could go out for a quick jog, informing her mother that she would only be gone about 20 minutes. After changing into her clothing, Laura let her family know that she would be home in time to eat and headed out the door. When 20 minutes came and went, the family grew concerned as Laura was not the type of child to dilly-dally along or not keep a promise. Bob very quickly heads out the door in an attempt to find his daughter. Bob Smithers drives the route that he and Laura take while they jog and bike, concerned that there's a possibility she might have turned her ankle or been hit by a car or something else may have occurred which has made her late. However, Bob Smither does not find any sign of his daughter, and upon returning home, he tells the family that he is going to call the police. And amazingly, the police arrive at the Smither home around 9:55 a.m. By the time the officer has arrived, there is a heavy rain falling in the area, and both of Laura's parents are beside themselves with worry. The officer takes a report on Laura and heads off. Obviously, the family's not going to sit idly by and wait for the police to go and search for their daughter. So, with their two vehicles, the Smithers head out to try and track down where Laura may have gone. We know that they talked to a group of construction workers who informed them that they had not seen Laura. Bob Smithers goes and makes a flyer of his daughter and begins distributing it throughout the neighborhood. Eventually, neighbors of the Smithers family, hearing of Laura's disappearance, show up on horseback to help the family look for Laura. You might be thinking that, wow, this is kind of overkill so quickly in an abduction case. This type of thing did not happen in Friendswood, and believe it or not, the sooner individuals get involved in action in looking for a missing person, the better the chances are of that individual being found, either alive or deceased. Then something rather amazing happens. One of the Smithers' friends, who worked as the chief of police for the local community college, gets wind of this and contacts the Friendswood Police Department, talking to the chief of police and explaining the situation and the fact that Laura Smithers was not the type of young girl to run away. She was a very studious, happy child. Now, this information makes the chief of police jump into action. He reassigns all 39 officers that are active in the Friendswood PD to go out and search for Laura. He also contacts the FBI and requests assistance. This is something that becomes more and more common in missing child cases as the 1990s moved on into the 2000s, and in fact, many times now when a child goes missing, police can't reach out to the FBI to kind of get some ideas from them, but also to put them on standby that, hey, we may need the government's help. The FBI, in turn, shows up on the scene, starts talking to the Smithers family, taps their telephone, and while the police and FBI eventually call the search off for the day due to the coming darkness and worsening weather conditions, the Smithers continue on in their search for returning to the house and making plans for the resumption of said search the following day. Now, according to her parents, around midnight on April 3rd, a psychic called the house and told them that he saw a vision of Laura lying in a field near a road. Figuring that they knew the area that the psychic had described, the Smithers go out that evening but are unable to locate Laura. By 4 a.m. on April 4th, they are back at their house where volunteers are already making preparations to search that day. Now, the search goes on the next day as members of the Friendswood community turn out, many of whom the Smithers had never met, in an effort to help the Smithers family find their daughter and bring her home. While this may be fairly common nowadays, back at this point in time, you really only saw this kind of come-togetherness in smaller communities. You'd rarely, if ever, see this type of effort put forth by individuals living in cities. Whether it's true concern in these larger metropolises or not, or simply a desire for people to feel like they are a part of something, as disappearances of this nature invariably draw massive amounts of mainstream media attention, the fact of the matter remains that these types of cases now are handled much differently by both law enforcement and by communities. Local TV stations began carrying stories of Laura's disappearance, and it really became an all-pervasive thing throughout the Houston metropolitan area. We know that later that afternoon, the police and FBI separately interviewed each member of the family, because obviously at this point, the parents are suspects in the disappearance of their daughter. As Bob later stated, during the course of the day, it dawned on him that the police, in fact, considered them suspects, and he understood why, offering the police the opportunity to search the entire house, take anything that they may consider evidence. While the local police department began compiling a list of known sex offenders living in the greater Houston/Galveston area, a list which eventually grows to over 2,100 individuals. They also began compiling a list of itinerant workers, i.e. construction workers, who were in the area. Asked about the police's efforts and Laura's disappearance, the chief of police for Friendswood, a man by the name of Jared Stout, said, quote, "It was as if Laura had been on the X-Files and just beamed up." Now, by the end of this second day, the official search for Laura is called off, with the police stating that their intention from this point forward was to narrow down the pool of suspects they had in her disappearance. Now, despite this, the following day, a Saturday, more volunteers showed up to help look for Laura. Over the course of the next week, these volunteer searches are going to continue, with the Smithers family, in their own words, cooperating with police fully. Bob Smithers later said, quote, "After a few days, you kind of run out of stories to tell yourself that are going to have a good ending, but I hoped." Well, Bob's wife, Gay, stated during this same interview, "I went into denial. I convinced myself that Laura was being held captive, and if I prayed enough, she'd be let go. Eventually, the search for Laura Smithers is going to become so big that the Texas New Mexico Power Company is going to donate a vacant building to be used for something that is eventually going to be termed as the Laura Recovery Center. So Laura's disappearance in this area is a huge deal, much larger than any other missing person case in the Houston-Galveston area had been up until this point. Laura's story ends up getting nationwide attention, and as a result, law enforcement is deluged with a slew of tips saying that people had seen her in places as far away as Oregon and New Jersey. Obviously, the police have to track down the veracity of many of these tips. However, after a few weeks, the Smithers realize that they cannot continue to ask their friends and neighbors to volunteer so much of their time in an effort to try and discover Laura's whereabouts, and they officially call off their search. They decided to hold an event marking the occasion on April 20th, 1997. Now, according to those in attendance at this gathering, during the course of his speech, Chief Stout stopped, looked at his pager, quickly thanked those in attendance before rushing off the stage. This obviously set those in attendance buzzing about what could have occurred to force the chief to abandon the speech that he was making. Many believed that something major had occurred, and they were right, although no one at the time knew it. Not long after this, people in Friendswood started hearing rumors that the body of a young girl had been found. Now, according to Bob and Gay, around 7 p.m., someone called their home asking if they'd heard anything about the reports that a body had been found. Gay says she dismissed this, saying to the person, "How dare you," before slamming the phone down. However, around 10 p.m. that evening, the chief of police shows up at their house and informs them that the nude, decomposing body of a young girl had been found wearing only her socks by a father and son who had been out training one of their dogs at a retention pond about 15 miles from the Smithers' front door. Now, Bob and Gay later learned that while searchers had been near the area, none of them had actually gone out to this retention pond to look around it. The body was actually discovered stuck inside of a water pipe inside of this retention pond, and according to official police reports, the current of the water flowing over the body had removed the majority of the skin and muscle from the upper portion of the body. Eventually, this body is going to be positively identified as belonging to Lauren Smither. The coroner's eventually going to determine that Lauren had been strangled to death. There was also some blunt force trauma to her lower extremities. Obviously, Laura's death absolutely devastated her family. And this is going to lead them to starting a nonprofit to help locate other children who have gone missing. Law enforcement had a number of different suspects who they considered for Laura Smithers' disappearance and murder. Most of these did not pan out, however. What most people didn't know at the time was, almost as soon as law enforcement became involved in Laura's disappearance, they had one suspect above all others who seemed to fit the bill. That was a 38-year-old convicted sex offender and rapist by the name of William Lewis Reese. Just 5 months prior to Laura's disappearance, Reese had been released from prison, having served a 10-year prison sentence for 2 counts of rape. At the time Laura disappeared, Reese had regained his driver's license and moved down to the Houston area where he was working as a bulldozer operator on one of the many subdivisions that was going up around the Smithers neighborhood. Police were able to determine that Reese had been let go for the day due to the inclement weather around the time that Laura went missing. We know that the work site that he had been on was adjacent to the Smithers home, and that in order to leave this work site, he would have had to drive on the street that Laura was running on. However, according to police at the time, while they believed that he was responsible for Laura's death, they didn't feel that there was enough evidence to link Reese to her murder conclusively. According to police files, Reese was polygraphed a number of times, with the results always being inconclusive. It was noted that during certain aspects of these polygraph examinations, particularly when questions concerning Laura Smithers was asked, Reese became unusually fidgety and began coughing. Basically, he was working to beat the test. He also allowed law enforcement to search the house and truck that he was driving during this point in time, although they turned up no evidence that led to Reese's arrest. Unfortunately, Laura's case is going to end up going cold. After Laura's disappearance, there was a slew of disappearances in and around Houston and Galveston. After Laura's disappearance, a 19-year-old mother of two named Sandra Sapog went missing from a parking lot. Unfortunately, Sandra is one of those who we would categorize as an at-risk victim. She's young, she's working in topless bars to try and make money, and I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that she may have been working as a prostitute on the side, but it's worth noting that many young women who do work in strip clubs turn to this side work as it's fairly lucrative. However, as we know from many, many other cases that we've covered in the past, that line of work really puts women in the crosshairs of sexual predators. On May 17th, Sandra pulled into the parking lot of a Webster, Texas convenience store. We know that on that night, Sandra had left the children with her father and gone back to the apartment that she had shared with her ex-husband to collect her and the children's belongings. We also know that her ex-husband gave her $200 to help Sandra and their children relocate and settle. Now, the reason that Sandra pulled into this convenience store, it's because she was planning on staying at a Motel 6 that was located directly across the street. However, it was booked solid that night, so Sandra decides to make a phone call from the payphone in this stop-and-go convenience store. According to her friend, as she was on the phone with, Sandra remarked that a man standing next to a large white pickup truck with dually tires on the back was giving her the creeps. She stated that the man was wearing jeans, a white short-sleeved t-shirt, and a black cowboy hat. After getting off the phone with her friend, Sandra drove across the street to a Waffle House, where she was expecting her friend, whom she'd just spoken to on the phone, to meet her. As she was leaving the mini-mart, Sandra noticed two things. that her minivan wasn't driving correctly and that the dually pickup truck was right up her ass. Pulling to the side of the road, the man in the truck pulled up and told Sandra that he noticed her tire was flat and offered to help her. As Sandra rummaged in the back of the minivan looking for a tire, the man went to the front of his truck for something and asked Sandra if she would look in the cab of his truck for a rag. She obliged him, only to discover the man standing behind her with a knife, informing her that if she screamed, she was dead. However, she got into the truck without any issues, there would be no problems. The man began to drive, informing her that he was taking her to Dallas. Instead, the man drove to the Motel 6. Sandra pleaded with the man to try and get him to go in to look for a room so that she could escape. However, the man wasn't interested, and eventually he moved the truck into the back parking lot. We know that he ordered her to take her pants off, that she refused, and that this threw the man into a rage, and he began driving down I-45, screaming at her the entire way. Eventually, Sandra decides that she's going to listen to what the man has told her to do. But instead, she makes a break for it. Having noticed that the passenger side door was open, she throws it open and prepares to leap out, only to be grabbed by the man from behind. Eventually, Sandra is able to escape from the man's grasp. She hit the ground hard, rolling, before realizing that the man was backing up. Now, about this time, a young woman by the name of Minerva Torres was driving down I-45. This was somewhere after 1 a.m. when a barefoot woman came flying out of the woods into the middle of the road, waving at her. Torres, who had her nephew in the car with her, was startled. She later said that the young boy said to her, "That woman's hurt, we need to go back and help her." At which point, Torres parks on the side of the road and runs back to the woman. Sandra lets the woman know that, "I just jumped from a truck," and there it is right there. Torres sees it backing towards them and gets Sandra in the car. As the three of them take off down the road, Sandra sees the man in the pickup truck pulling off the side of the road and hitting a U-turn, driving away from where they had been. Minerva was planning on taking Sandra to the nearest hospital. However, Sandra convinced the woman to bring her to the Waffle House where her friend was waiting for her. Once at the Waffle House, Minerva ran inside, demanding that the woman working the counter contact the police as well as an ambulance before rushing back to her car to see if she could find something to help stem Sandra's bleeding, as Sandra had cut herself pretty badly leaping from the truck. Once the police arrive, Sandra gives a fairly good description of the man who had attempted to abduct her, listing him as around 5'9", 200 pounds with dirty blonde hair and a mustache, and what she described as loose facial skin or bags underneath his eyes. She said that the truck was a older model white Chevy or Ford, possibly a diesel. Minerva Torres gave an identical description of the truck. We know that Sandra spent 3 days in the hospital before being released into a halfway house for abused women. Sandra ends up eventually being put under hypnosis, although she's unable to recall any further events from the night that she had been nearly abducted than she had already given to police. Unbeknownst to Sandra, another woman had seen this man who had abducted her at the Stop and Go, and that was the clerk who was working at the convenience store. Shortly before Sandra's ordeal began, she had walked out to throw some items in the dumpster and seen the man. However, she described his hat as tan, not black. Eventually, this young woman would be able to provide police with a further description of the man, including a gold nugget pinky ring that he wore. The next case we're going to look at has a number of different tellings. All of them concern a 20-year-old woman by the name of Kellyanne Cox, who on July 15, 1997, went missing. One story from the Department of Public Safety in Texas's own website lists that on that date, Kelly Cox had gone to the local jail in Denton, Texas, home of the Von Erich wrestling family, for a tour which was linked to a class that Kelly was taking in college. Now, upon leaving this tour, Kelly went to her car, which was parked at a convenience store across the street from the police station, only to discover that she had locked her keys inside of the car. Kelly contacts her boyfriend, explaining the situation. He agrees to drive out and help her. However, when her boyfriend arrives, Kelly is nowhere to be seen, and there is very little in the way of information as to what may have happened to her. Then, on August 17th, another young woman would go missing. This time it was a 17-year-old by the name of Jessica Lee Kane. Jessica lived with her parents on Tiki Island, which is a rather affluent community that lies underneath the Galveston Causeway. At this point, amazingly enough, Jessica was enrolled in Sam Houston State University in Huntsville. On the night of her disappearance, Jessica had been at the Harbor Playhouse in Dickinson, where she was performing. We know that after this performance, Jessica drove her father's 1992 Ford pickup to a Bennigan's, after which she and other cast members went back to one of their apartments. At some point after 1 a.m., Jessica told one of her friends that she was tired, not feeling well, and was thinking of going home. Friends drove her from this apartment back to the Bennigan's and watched her get into the truck and drive off in the direction of her house. We know that Jessica's mother, Susie, stayed up waiting for her daughter. However, she fell asleep at some point, waking up around 2:30, to find that her 17-year-old daughter was not home. Concerned, Susie then wakes up Jessica's father, who, in his own words, panicked. So her father, who worked for Exxon at this point, heads out to find his daughter, going first to the Bennigan's and then trying to track what he assumes would have been his daughter's way home. Around 4 a.m., he finds the pickup truck pulled to the shoulder of I-45 on the southbound side. Inside of this truck, he sees that Jessica's wallet, keys, and driver's license are on the seat and that the truck is locked. Contacting the police, Jessica's father quickly explains the situation. They arrive on the scene, and to give an idea of how affluent the family was, he explained to the officers that their daughter had a cell phone with her, however, she did not take it with her on that night. Amazingly, the Sykes family become involved, helping to console Canes, while Tim Miller, father of Laura Lynn Miller, who, if you recall, had gone missing on February 2nd, 1986, used a nonprofit that he had created after his daughter's disappearance and murder to help search for Jessica Kane. This was an undertaking that Miller, to the best of my knowledge, continues to do up until this day, helping parents across the country locate their missing children. Jessica's disappearance received quite a bit of attention at the time, as it came so close on the heels of two other young women having gone missing. police were able to get very little evidence, with two exceptions. People driving on I-45 that early morning had seen two vehicles. One was a red Isuzu. The other was a light-colored pickup with a toolbox in the back and lights on the cab. Police released this information. Unfortunately, however, things went cold fairly quickly. It's following Jessica's disappearance that local media outlets really began reporting on the mysteries of what were dubbed the Texas Killing Fields, and how so many young girls and women had gone missing, either never to be seen again, or to be found at a later date deceased. Now, just after all of this happens, a detective working for the Alvin Police Department by the name of Sue Dietrich leaves the Alvin Police Department and goes to the Tiki Island Police Department, where she is installed as chief of police. According to Dietrich, on October 3rd of 1997, she drove up to Friendswood PD to talk with Jared Stout, who was the chief of police there. Now, according to Dietrich, as she and Stout are talking, the murder of Laura Smither comes up. Stout informs Dietrich that he has a suspect for Laura's murder, a man by the name of William Lewis Reese. According to Dietrich, at that point, she didn't really put two and two together until later that night, when she awoke and, in her own words, basically had a premonition that this Reese character may in fact be the same person that they're looking for. She recalled Sandra's attempted abduction, and upon recalling this, reached out to the Friendswood Police Department and informed them that they may want to have a talk with the Webster Police Department. So police begin comparing notes, and they realize that this Reese character matches Sandra's description of the man who had attempted to abduct her, not only in physical appearance, but also in the truck that he had been driving. Further, it's found that this truck matches the truck seen around the time that Jessica Kane went missing. Now, you would think that with all of this information, they can move in and start really checking out this William Reese character. When police finally do bring Reese in, he has shaved his mustache and removed the toolbox from the back of his truck, replacing it with a camper. Reese shows up with a lawyer, and when asked whether or not he'd be willing to stand in on a lineup, Reese declines. Officers later said that during the entire conversation with Reese, he was laughing and cracking jokes with them. The next day, officers did a phone lineup with Sandra, and she instantaneously picked Reese as the man who had attempted to abduct her. So now, who is William Lewis Reese? Reese was born July 1st, 1959, in Yukon, Oklahoma. He was one of 13 siblings. Although Reese spent a lot of time growing up living in foster homes due to his family's financial situation. In high school, Reese ends up dropping out after the ninth grade and takes a job working as a farrier, that is, shoeing horses. After this, it appears as though he worked as a truck driver, a ranch hand in rodeos, shoeing horses, as well as in construction. In 1979, he meets a young woman by the name of Judy Fleming, and she ends up getting pregnant. The two of them end up married. According to Fleming, Reese was a quote-unquote mama's boy, gotten into some trouble during his youth, which was the real reason that he had been sent away to a foster care home. She also said that after getting married, Reese had joined the Oklahoma National Guard, although that this was short-lived. Now, she ends up getting divorced from Reese, although he convinces her to marry him again. They end up having two children together. Fleming said that her marriage to Reese was fairly terrifying, describing in one news article an account how he had made her go to a relative's house for Thanksgiving one year, become furious with her, thrown her to the ground, and held a shotgun to her head until Reese's mother stepped in and calmed him down. After their divorce, she said Reese had visited her and the children at one point, driving them to get diapers before starting an argument and letting her know that if she didn't do what he wanted her to do, he was going to kill everybody in the car. After which point, Reese drove down a country road as fast as he could before eventually stopping. After his divorce, in 1986, Reese kidnapped the 19-year-old daughter of a sheriff's deputy. The woman had been driving when her car broke down. Reese, who was driving a semi-truck at this point, saw her, pulled to the side of the road, and feigned being a Good Samaritan, eventually getting the woman into his truck under the promise of driving her to a nearby payphone. Once inside of his truck, Reese turns on the young woman, duct taping her arms, hitting her, and telling her that he loves her. When the woman asks him why he's doing this, Reese tells her that he's crazy. Now, there are different reports of this story. Some state that Reese forced her to perform oral sex on him numerous times. Others that it only occurred once. In any event, the woman realizes that she's in a really bad situation and is able to convince Reese to let her use the bathroom. And while there with witnesses around, she convinces him to allow her to make a phone call to her family, as Reese had been telling her that he loved her and that they were going to be together forever, that they were going to live in Houston. For some unknown reason, Reese gives this young lady a quarter, and she uses it to call the police. Reese is arrested and charged with kidnapping and oral sodomy. He ends up making bail, and after making bail, he goes on to commit a further rape the following month after following a woman home from a bar. She too presses charges against William Reese, and he is eventually found guilty and sentenced to 26 years in prison. However, on appeal, his lawyers claim that there were procedural misconduct, and this is knocked down to 10 years. Now, in October of 1996, William Reese is released from prison. He goes to live with his mother in Anadarko, Oklahoma, where he meets a woman by the name of Kathy Dobry, who was one of his mother's friends. We know that she was familiar with Reese, that she is, in fact, the woman who took him to get his driver's license so that he could move down to Houston. After that, Reese settles into life working in construction. Then, on July 26, 1997, Tiffany Johnson goes missing from Bethany, Oklahoma. Tiffany, who was newly married at this point, had been at a local car wash cleaning her car when she simply vanished. Her vehicle was found with the keys still in the ignition and the floor mats hanging nearby to dry, although no one at the car wash saw anything. The next day, on July 27, 1997, Tiffany Johnson is discovered. This was about 15 miles from where she had last been seen. She was partially clothed, lying in the tall grass alongside an unpaved road, not far from an interstate. Medical examiner would later state that Tiffany had been sexually assaulted and strangled, and DNA was able to be recovered from Tiffany's body. However, at the time of Tiffany's disappearance and murder, DNA had not progressed to such a point that police could use it to find a suspect. Police don't know anything about Tiffany as they're looking into Reese for the kidnapping of Sandra. On October 16th of 1997, they surround the rundown apartment that Reese is living in on Fauna Street in downtown Houston and arrest him for kidnapping. Inside Reese's apartment, police find a black cowboy hat similar to the one that Sandra said she had seen him wearing. Inside of the truck, they discover two knives. One, a switchblade, which was tucked down into the pocket on the driver's side door. Now, Sandra is at the police station waiting for a lineup. And at this lineup, all of the individuals are instructed to say, "Stay down, bitch," a line that Sandra said her assailant had said to her. According to officers, as soon as Reese came walking out, her eyes locked on him and never left. And after all of the individuals in this lineup had said, "Stay down, bitch," she identified William Reese as the man who had abducted her. Reese is then charged with kidnapping. Now, right after Reese's name and picture hits the local newspapers, police in Webster and Friendwood are deluged by women coming forward telling of their own encounters with the man. One of these calls came from an employer of Reese who owned a ranch in Friendswood, who told police that he was forced to keep an eye on Reese as numerous young women who kept their horses stabled at his farm had complained about the attention that he gave them. They also learned that a few days after Jessica Kane went missing, Reese had used his bulldozer without prompting at the farm to move a large pile of manure. The police suspected at the time that this may be linked to Jessica's disappearance and murder, and thus they searched the property for two full days using cadaver dogs, although at the time nothing was discovered. All of this is going on. Police in Friendswood announced that their main suspect in the disappearance of Laura Smithers had been arrested for aggravated kidnapping. While he's sitting in the jail, Reese gives an interview where he states, quote, "It's a crock. They need someone. They don't have anyone. I know it's not me. They have nothing. They know they have nothing. I'm not the kind of person to kill. I would never hurt kids. The real killer is still out there." Now, unknown to Bill Reese, police had uncovered fibers in both his apartment and in his truck that were consistent with fibers that had been found on the socks Laura Smithers had been wearing when she was discovered. Obviously, police think that they have their man in William Reese. They just don't have the evidence, so they have to be content with the fact that Reese is being charged with aggravated kidnapping. And around this time, it emerged that there had been a mishandling of Laura's remains at the morgue where she was being autopsied. Her body had been contaminated by that of another murder victim, and it was believed that hairs from that other murder victim had ended up on Laura's body. Something that had the police brought William Reese to trial for Laura's murder, the defense could have used to persuade a jury he was not responsible, or to have the case thrown out on appeals were he convicted. William Reese's trial ends up starting on April 29th, 1998. Reese is identified by both Sandra and the clerk who had worked at the convenience store where Sandra had seen him prior to her abduction. And eventually, William Reese is going to be convicted of aggravating kidnapping. During the sentencing phase, both of his prior rape victims came forward, the second victim revealing that Reese had broken into her house and she had awoken to him between her legs, ripping her clothing off. When she had tried to struggle, he had choked her, telling her, "If you wake anyone up, I will kill you." Reese ends up getting a 60-year sentence for the aggravating kidnapping charge. However, the story does not end there. The Smithers family end up suing Reese and being awarded a $110 million default judgment. So as Reese is sitting in prison, police continue to look at him for the various crimes they suspect him of, particularly in Oklahoma, where police strongly consider him as the only suspect in the murder of 19-year-old Tiffany Johnson. In the summer of 2014, police in Oklahoma reopened Tiffany's case, as they had that DNA from her body, and they got a partial DNA match. That partial profile matched William Lewis Reese. Further, they had a calling card that had been used at a payphone 7 miles from where Tiffany had gone missing that was tied to William Reese and had been used on the day Tiffany had gone missing. Now, unbeknownst to anyone, as this information is slowly leaking out, investigators in Texas begin to reopen the cases that they believe Reese is responsible for in their jurisdictions. He ends up being extradited to Oklahoma in July of 2016 to stand trial for the murder of Tiffany Johnson. Now, Reese ends up admitting responsibility for Tiffany's murder to a Texas ranger by the name of James Holland. During this confession, he also confesses to the murders of Cox, Smithers, and Kane, going so far as to provide a map with the burial sites of Kellyanne Cox and Jessica Kane. Kellyanne Cox's remains were located in Brazoria County, Texas. Although, as of this recording, I have not been able to find anything indicating where Jessica Lee Kane's remains were found. So now, what ends up happening is Reese ends up being found guilty of Tiffany's murder in Oklahoma, despite the fact that during his confession, he intentionally misled authorities by giving false information in the hopes that this would lead to his confession being thrown out as inadmissible in court. Reese stated that the Texas Ranger who he confessed to had offered him things such as helicopter rides, McDonald's, cigarette, and dip in exchange for him providing information related to all of these murders and the recovery of the victim's remains. On August 19th of 2021, Reese is sentenced to death by the Oklahoma County District Court. In March of 2022, Reese is extradited to Texas, where he pleads guilty to the murders of Laura Smither, Jessica Kane, and Kellyanne Cox, which lands him a prison term of life in prison without the possibility of parole. He is currently incarcerated at the Polunsky Unit in Texas, and as of the release of this episode, he has been denied an appeal by the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, which on July 10th of 2025 found that his confession had not been coerced and that his death sentence was to be upheld. Reese has maintained that while he did commit all of these murders, there was never a sexual motive behind any of them, despite evidence to the contrary that contradicts his statements. We are going to end the episode at this point. However, we are still not done with the Texas killing fields. There's at least one more episode coming where we are going to discuss the last of the cases tied to this series of murders, and also the major suspects who have never been convicted of these crimes that I did not touch on in earlier episodes. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid!